listening to Rockland World Radio, heard around the world. Hence, Rockland World Radio.
I'm independent. You know it. You love it. You can't live without it. Rockland World Radio.
This program is brought to you by Real Life, Real Talk, encouraging open, honest, and balanced talk about sex and relationships. Online at reallifereeltalk.org. That's reallifereeltalk.org.
Real Life, Real Talk presents a question from a parent.
Do I talk about sex with my son when he's young or when he's a teen?
Answer, yes. When you start the conversation early, it gets easier to talk as he grows for both of you. And opening the lines of communication early means fewer risks later on. Trade one big talk for many little ones. When it comes to understanding sexuality, more talk is better. Want help with the conversation? Check out Sex Ed for Parents. Go to reallifereeltalk.org.
Good morning and welcome to Real Life, Real Talk. I'm your host, Tiffany Card. Here at Real Life, Real Talk, we are working to help parents become more comfortable in talking with their kids and each other about healthy sexuality. This morning we have Jackson Katz, who is an educator, author, and filmmaker who is internationally recognized for his groundbreaking work in gender violence prevention education with men and boys, particularly in the sports culture and military. He is co-founder of the Mentors in Violence Prevention Program, also known as MVP, which is the most widely utilized sexual and domestic violence prevention program in college and professional athletics. It has been implemented by about one quarter of the teams in the NFL, including the New England Patriots, as well as the 2007 World Series champion Boston Red Sox, and a growing number of Major League Baseball clubs. Since 1997, Katz has been directing the first worldwide gender violence prevention program in the history of the United States Marine Corps. Katz is the creator of the award-winning and widely used educational videos for college and high school schools, including Tough Guys, Violence, Media, and the Crisis in Masculinity, Wrestling with Manhood, Spin the Bottle, Sex, Lies, and Alcohol. His first book, entitled The Macho Paradox, Why Some Men Hurt Women and How All Men Can Help, was published last year by Source Books. Good morning, Jackson.
Good morning, Tiffany.
How are things out there in California?
Just charming. We're getting a little winter, which is unusual for this area, as you know, but it's well needed.
Great. Well, I thought, you know, you would be one of the most interesting people to talk with regarding masculinity and looking at all your research and the work that you've done around this issue. And I thought what would be most interesting to talk about is that very often in our programs, we talk to parents about how to talk to their kids about sexuality. And as I have been out in the community, I have noticed that people feel like they have to talk to their young girls about this and sort of have this attitude that, well, I don't have to talk to my boy because, you know, guys just want to have sex. And I keep hearing sort of this mentality and thought, wait, there's something really, you know, something's being going on here. And I thought perhaps we could talk about that today and look at sort of that role of masculinity in some of the work that you've done, particularly looking at your film Tough Guys, which I have to tell people is actually Tough, G-U-I-S-E. Can you talk a little bit about the work that you did in that film?
Sure. And thanks for having me on, and thanks for wanting to focus on this obviously incredibly important aspect of sexuality and parenting and such. Tough Guys, the film Tough Guys, we look at the ways in which media culture helps to construct or define a certain kind of manhood, and that boys growing up in this culture and men growing up in this culture are exposed to enormous numbers of images on a daily basis and sort of about what it means to be a man. And the argument here that we make is that while media doesn't cause violence, no thoughtful person would make that simplistic a claim, that violent masculinity is a cultural norm in the United States, which is to say when boys and men act out violently, both towards girls and women, towards other men and boys, and towards themselves, we shouldn't be shocked and surprised. In fact, our culture is teaching boys and men that in many ways, part of being a man means being in control, being powerful, using force or the threat of force to establish or maintain our power or our control in a relationship, etc. And the media, being the great teaching force of our time, the great pedagogical force of our time, it's important to critically examine the images that are presented to boys and men in media. So that's what we do throughout Tough Guys.
You also, I thought, was very interesting, you know, in the film itself, several young men are interviewed, and they're asked, you know, what is a real man? And it's interesting to actually hear. Can you talk a little bit about some of those things that they actually define and that they already have gotten a message of a very particular way of what a real man is supposed to be?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what most young men will answer if you ask them what is a real man, they'll answer the most obvious, I think, maybe to some of us it's obvious, cultural stereotypes of manhood: strong, tough, provider, in control, things like that. It seems pretty clear that they're focused on the physical aspects and the sort of power aspects of manhood more likely than other forms of abstract characteristics that I think many of us would hope that both men and women would aspire to, about being a good person, being compassionate, etc. I think these guys have gotten the message, young guys, adolescent males have gotten the message, early on, that being a man means, or a real man especially, means being powerful and in control. And also that, you know, there's obviously sexist and homophobic implications of that, because being a real man means you're not a woman or like a woman, and it means, in the traditional sense, being a real man means you're not gay, because that's the current, the traditional definition of manhood does not include sexual diversity.
And I think also what's interesting about this as well is, just as you said, is that, you know, very often we say, well, what's wrong with being strong? What's wrong with being a provider? Sometimes that's an argument that says, you know, are you saying that these qualities are bad?
Right, and of course that's a misreading of people. People make those kind of simplistic misreadings all the time. Of course it doesn't mean it's anything wrong with being strong or being a provider. And both men and women can be strong and be providers. It's not; those are not gendered qualities. Strength and taking care of your family. Those are not gendered qualities. I mean, the problem is not being strong or being a provider. The problem is how you define strength. And the problem is that if you define strength in physical terms and being in control and physical control, and then you're leading to, you know, the inevitability of violence in relationships.
And I think that's where it was interesting to look at and leading toward down this road. If we're talking to our young, you know, our young people, and we say we have an 11 or 12-year-old boy in our household, and they're already getting these kinds of messages, and we're looking at sexuality, then what are the kinds of things that this kind of behavior might play out in the terms of sexual behavior?
Well, I think, Tiffany, in the context of that question and concern of parents, I mean, I think we have to talk about the primary form of sexual socialization in the culture for young boys, and it's pornography. So what these boys are learning in pornography, and that's by far the most important form of sex education or sex miseducation in the culture, what they're learning in pornography, boys are and men are, about manhood, is not that sexual relationships involve mutual pleasures and taking care of each other's feelings. In pornography, the way that manhood is constructed, generally speaking, and I'm talking about the mainstream of pornography, I'm not talking about extremes, the way that manhood is constructed in pornography or defined is basically men are in complete control over women, who are essentially there to service men's sexual needs. And at the same time that men are being serviced by women sexually, they're degrading them, they're ridiculing them, they're calling them names. So, I mean, the level of eroticized abuse and violence in the primary form of sexual socialization for boys is astounding. And in the absence of good, healthy sexual talk, sexual education, parents talking to their kids honestly and openly about these issues, I think boys are getting a very twisted and distorted understanding of what it means to be a man in sexual terms.
I mean, we're also looking, I'm looking at some statistics here. We have 99.8% of the people in prison convicted of rape are men. And I think the other piece to this is looking at thinking, well, my son would never do something like that. And I think in your book, The Macho Paradox, Why Some Men Hurt Women and How All Men Can Help, is looking at the chapter that specifically talks about it takes a village. It takes a village to rape a woman. And you talk about, again, repeating some of the other things that people talk about rapist values, and looking at not necessarily, you know, the extremes of those, but talking about sort of this other, you know, mentality of maybe a college kid who, you know, doesn't really take no for an answer, and how this all plays out in exactly what you're talking about as far as the macho paradox. Can you talk a little bit about It Takes a Village to Rape a Woman? What exactly do you mean by that?
Yes. The basic idea behind that title is that somehow the idea that the problem of rape is the problem of these sick and aberrant individuals who somehow crawl out of the ooze to do their bad deeds is a very naive one. That, in fact, rape, sadly, and sexual violence is much more common than that would suggest. And the men who commit rape and the boys who commit rape and sexual violence are not, you know, psychologically twisted. They're not sociopathic. In most cases, obviously, there are some who are, but the vast majority of men and boys who are sexually abusive and sexually violent are not the caricature of a monster. They're much more normal than that. They're much more like average guys, and I think that makes a lot of people very uncomfortable, because if the most men who are rapists were so sick and different from the rest of us, then we could rest a little easy and say, okay, it's not really about us, it's about those crazy guys. But the fact is that's not the case in most cases, and so therefore we have to look internally, or we have to, as a society, be introspective. We have to say, what is it about our society that's producing all these abusive men? And what about the institutions of our society that sort of socialized boys are located in this problem of rape? And, I mean, that's a little more, to say the least, discomforting to a lot of people, including parents, and parents of sons, and I am a parent of a son, because, you know, we have to look at ourselves and the ways in which we're exposing our kids to a set of ideas and values that are, I think, in so many ways, very antisocial. And the media culture is one place. I'm not saying it's the only place, but it's one place that I spent a lot of my time examining how what I call rapist values are normalized in men's lives.
Yeah, I mean, and I think the problem with this idea of the concept of rape is that we tend to, as a society, still think about sort of the alleyway and, you know, the dark shadowy figure, and not recognizing that more often than not, that it's actually someone that we know. And how do we talk to our young boys that about this, about how to be with women in regards to sexuality? I mean, they're getting such mixed messages. You know, you look at the videos, women are seen as property. The more girls that you have hanging off of you, dripping off of you, the more man that you are. And thinking, you know, well, I have a son, he's 11 or 12, but you know what, he doesn't behave that way, so I don't really need to say anything to him. How do we contradict the messages that they're seeing, and how do we know what kind of man that son is going to be?
Well, I mean, those are really good questions. I think we need, among other things, widespread implementation of media literacy in schools and in every other educational setting. In other words, we need to critically examine both kids and parents need to be media literate. We need to be thoughtful and knowledgeable about not only what our kids are watching and listening to, but we need to be up on the latest thinking about those things and try to understand how various values are inculcated both in kids and in adults through media. And by the way, the effects of media are much more about normalizing behavior, creating social norms and producing them and then reproducing them, than they are about causing people to act in certain ways. It has more to do with defining what is, you know, what is masculine and what is feminine, and the media's role in all of that. And I think parents of sons need to be, you know, especially vigilant, because to say that, you know, oh, our kids are my son's fine, and you know, he's not really affected by all this. I think it's just naive in the extreme. It doesn't mean that boys, all boys, are going to become abusive. Of course, most are not going to be. But to think that they're not affected, that boys and young men aren't affected by the norms of masculine behavior that are presented to them on a daily basis in media, to think that that's not affecting them is ridiculous. Of course, it's affecting them. It doesn't mean that there's a one-to-one relationship between exposure to, you know, rape in movies or in pornography and the guy becoming a rapist. Of course, it doesn't mean that. But if you're concerned with your son's growing sexual self and his healthy sort of sexuality and going forward in his life, then I think it's to say the least, important to be aware of the way in which he's been taught about what it means to be a healthy sexual man in the media system. And, you know, pornography is a big part of the media. And to say that, you know, to let these just be on their own on the internet or out in the world in which they access media in so many different ways is, I think, unfair to them. I think we need to be much more proactive in their media lives.
I also think, and I think you address this in your book and in your film, which is to say that with all these, with the ideas of what a real man is and the images that they're getting, they're also, what they're not getting is the idea that they can be emotional, that they can be sensitive, and that they can feel and cry. And I go back to this comment that someone had said, which was they weren't going to talk to their son about sex, but they were going to, if they had a daughter, they would lock her up. And we also talk about how, you know, early sexual activity may have emotional repercussions on young ones. And I think our focus is very often on young women and how it affects young women. And we never talk about how those same experiences affect young men.
Yeah, I mean, and Tiffany, the implication of saying I'm going to lock up my young daughters is that there's all these men out there and young men who are, you know, a danger to my daughter, right? So by definition, if parents of daughters are concerned about their daughters because the men out there are going to be assaulting them or taking advantage of them, then what about the parents of the sons? I mean, it seems obvious that something's missing if we think that we think we're only going to talk to our daughters. And by the way, the idea of even you know, locking up our daughters is, again, naive. I mean, it's not realistic. It's and one of the things that I say in my book and also in my work more general, in the field of sexual assault prevention, so-called prevention, up until very recently, it hasn't really been about prevention, as far as I'm concerned. It's been about risk reduction for women and girls. We teach women and girls how to avoid situations of risk. Don't put your drink down at a party because of a possibility of a rape drug being dropped in it by a guy, or look in the back seat of your car before you get in, or don't go out at night, or make sure that you have friends, or be escorted, especially at night, etc. These are all risk reduction strategies for girls and women. They're not prevention, because true prevention means really going to the source of the problem, and the source of the problem of sexual violence is not women. Women aren't raping themselves. I mean, the problem is overwhelmingly men and boys. And so, by definition, prevention means working with men and boys. And it doesn't mean working with men and boys in a negative way, like, you know, they go in and stop them from raping. It's we need, from the earliest ages, to be talking to boys and men about what it means to be in a relationship or respecting yourself and others in a sexual way. And in the absence of those kind of conversations, boys are getting the information from the media, especially from pornography, and it's not happy, to say the least.
And actually, you actually bring me up to another point that you often refer to of, you know, of looking at the idea of prevention and going, you said, to the source and looking at who the perpetrators are. And in this culture, we often talk about victims of domestic violence and looking at how that sort of leaves out who the perpetrator is or who the bystander is. You have been particularly using, you know, the idea of men's violence against women or men's violence. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, again, the way that we talk about subject shapes the way that we think about it. And the way that we so often talk about things like sexual violence and domestic violence is we use the passive voice. So we talk about how many women were abused or how many women were the victims of sexual harassment or how many women were raped or how many teenage girls got pregnant in this or that community. In each case, the use of the passive voice shifts our attention off of men and boys and puts it, you know, onto girls and women. So I think we need to really critically examine how we're thinking about these issues, because the way that we're thinking, again, continues the focus on women and girls to the exclusion of a focus on men and boys. So I say things like, instead of saying how many, you know, women were raped, why don't we ask how many men raped women? Or instead of saying how many teenage girls got pregnant, what about saying how many men and boys impregnated teenage girls? And the reason why I say that one, by the way, is that most teen pregnancies, the classic case is not that two 14-year-olds have sex and the girl gets pregnant. It's a 19-year-old guy and a 14-year-old girl. It's a 27-year-old guy and a 15-year-old girl. But where are adult men in the conversation about teen pregnancy? Virtually absent. And so part of the work here is to change our framework. It's a paradigm shift that we need. And instead of continually focusing on women and girls as victims or potential victims, we need to talk about men and boys. And not just men and boys as perpetrators or potential perpetrators, because much of my work focuses on the role that men play in our peer cultures, in our families, in our friendship circles, on teens, schools, guys who are not abusive to women and girls, but who don't speak up when our friends are. And so part of the work is to try to get men to start challenging each other to say, hey, man, you know, you're my friend, but I don't want to be talking about your girlfriend, or that joke about rape isn't funny. That could be my mother you're talking about here. Because if we create a climate in male peer culture that whereby abusive talk about women, abusive behavior towards girls, sexually or any other way, is seen as completely socially unacceptable, if guys will lose status for acting that way and talking that way, lose status with their other male friends and peers, then I think we're going to see the rates of sexual and other forms of men's violence against women come way down.
And I think you bring up a great point also in speaking about the bystander. I mean, certainly that's a conversation that we can have with our 11 or 12-year-old sons and talking about what kind of man do they want to be and talking about, you know, how you behave in school. You know, are you the kind of person that's going to step up and say something, and providing them with some of those qualities and being able to have that conversation in that way, as opposed to sort of, you know, most often people think, well, you know, I don't want to make it sound like all men are bad.
Right. Right. Again, that's a really, really good point. And earlier you asked me about the constraints and people saying what's wrong with being strong. Well, there's nothing wrong with being strong. It's something we should aspire to and help our kids aspire to. But it's how you define strength that's the issue. So is strength a guy who's making every decision in a relationship and telling his girlfriend what she can wear and her friends can be? Is that being strong? Or is being strong respecting girls as your equals, if you're a boy, I mean, and treating her with the respect that you people to treat you with? To me, that's more of a definition of strength that I would aspire to. And so, yes, being a man of conscience, a young man who wants to do the right thing, when he sees something wrong or he sees somebody being treated or mistreated, he speaks up, supports them, and challenges the person who's mistreating them. That, to me, is a definition of strength that I would get behind. And if more parents would emphasize that with their boys, their sons, then I think we'd begin to repair some of the damage that's being right now in terms of the norms in male culture. Because right now, men who challenge other men's sexism is such a rare thing in the public sphere that so very few boys growing up actually see concrete examples of men challenging other men or acting out in sexist or degrading ways towards women and girls. It's very sad, but that's something that adult men need to be doing a lot more of to model that behavior for our sons.
I was actually going to mention that in the regards of talking about men's violence against women, and in your film and in your book, you know, you use a lot of statistics and looking at the violence, you know, perpetrated by men. In pretty much every single case, it's, you know, the majority, vast majority, anywhere between, you know, 80 to 95, 99% of crimes, of violence, of sexual assault, of abuse is done by men. And as you mentioned before, that piece is often left out as if these things just happen, but no one's actually doing them. And in your work, how much backlash do you see in sort of putting a face to this stuff?
Well, it's a good question. I think there's defensiveness on the part of a lot of men who are used to not being challenged about these things. One of the key characteristics of privilege is the ability to go sort of invisible or unexamined, or you're not challenged. I think there are even plenty of women who defend men who whether they have sons or other men in their lives, they'll say things like, "My son's a good person and my husband's a good man. He wouldn't do anything like that," as if they were being accused of it. I mean, the fact is, over 99% of rape is perpetrated by men, but the vast majority of men are not rapists. Those two things can exist, coexist. Those two statistics can exist simultaneously. So as a man, for example, when I hear the statistic that over 99% of rape is perpetrated by men, whether the victims are female or male, and by the way, 90% of rape victims are female, but approximately 10% are male, and most of the perpetrators of rape, most of the people who rape men and boys are other men and boys, although we do know that there are some sexual abuse of boys by adult women, and that's a sad reality too that needs to be acknowledged. But the point is, when I hear that the vast majority of rape is perpetrated by men, I don't get defensive and think I'm being attacked. I think I'm a man, and what can I do about this problem? Because other men are doing something that I think, to say the least, is wrong, and I need to speak up. So there is defensiveness, but I think we need to address it and move beyond it.
I'm also hearing, and also because I've heard you speak before, that this sounds like a man's issue and not a woman's issue.
Yeah, I mean, clearly women have been the leaders, Tiffany. I mean, women in a multicultural sense have built the battered women's movement, the rape crisis movement. Even when it comes to sexuality education and healthy sexuality, I mean, women have been central to these, both intellectually, politically, and socially in every other way, talking about these issues, raising them in the culture, trying to reform the sort of educational practices around talking honestly about relationships. Women have been right up at the front, obviously. But my point is that that men also need to be part of this conversation in a much more profound way, and especially men who are leaders in our society, not just boys. You know, this shouldn't be on the shoulder of 14-year-old boys or 10-year-old boys or 19-year-old guys, you know. It should be on the shoulder of powerful men in the community, educational leaders, political leaders, business leaders, faith leaders. Adult men need to be engaging with women on these issues and figuring out a way that we can sort of transform the culture and the way in which boys are socialized so that we don't have such a normalization of abuse that we do today. That's what I mean by when I say it's a men's issue. Not that it's not also a women's issue, but that men more specifically need to be involved.
And just in the last few minutes here, I think it's very interesting, again, to go back to this idea that this parent that I overheard say, you know, he didn't need to talk to his son about sexuality. Given the work that you do, what might you say to that parent, or what some of the things that that parent could say to their son in regards to sexuality?
Well, there's so much, because as I said earlier, in the absence of that conversation, pornography and the pornographic culture takes over as the teacher of our sons. So I think one of the first things we need to find out as parents of sons is, where are our kids learning? Where are our sons learning about sex? What do they know right now, and why do they know what they know, and where have they learned it? Because in part, I think if parents are naive about the amount of sexual miseducation their sons have already gotten through the internet and other forms of media, then they're starting at a deficit. So I think finding out what they already know and where they know it, and this can be an awkward conversation for someone who's never had it. But what's the alternative? What's the alternative to not talking to your sons that they're going to be sexually socialized by basically rich guys in suits in the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles who are basically producing incredible porn? I mean, there were 10,000 porn videos released last year in the United States alone. 10,000. To think that young boys are not accessing that on the internet is, I think, is living in a fantasy world. And when I was a kid, when I was a boy, there was no internet. And yet if there was, I would have been one of those boys, you know, going online. Because, you know, if you're going through a sexual awakening and you're turned on by images of women's nude bodies, et cetera, you're going to, you know, and you have the access to the Internet, you're going to go look. I mean, I don't have any doubt, and there's nothing wrong with that. What happens when these boys go to the Internet and go to pornography to... for various reasons, to satisfy their sexual desires or curiosities, what they get there is not sex or healthy relationships or bodies having sex with each other. They get an incredible level of abusive behavior by men that's normalized, and an incredible level of degradation of women that's connected to the sexual act. And so I would say, for parents of sons, talk to them about what they are already doing and where they've learned what they've learned, and then figure out ways to counteract that. And, I mean, the golden rule is the simplest one. I mean, we can go back to the ancient wisdom, right? The golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do to you. So if you want to be treated with disrespect, you want to be degraded and ridiculed and marginalized and treated like an object, you know, why say it like that? I shouldn't say it negatively. No one wants to. So, therefore, don't treat other people like that.
Thank you so much, Jackson, for talking with us today and the work that you're doing out there. And I remind folks again that the book is called The Macho Paradox, Why Some Men Hurt Women and How All Men Can Help. I also know that you have a website, jacksonkatz.com, I believe. And
yes.
Thank you so much for coming on and doing our show today.
Thank you very much, Tiffany, for having me on. And I hope going forward that a lot more of the men in your community who obviously are concerned about their sons and daughters, take advantage of the cultural moment that we're in, because there's a whole lot more work and people out there talking about men and masculinity in a multicultural way and dialoguing with women, and I hope that this at least is an introduction to some of those men to take the next step. So thank you very much.
Thank you. So for folks listening, again, you can go to reallifereeltalk.org to find out more information about how to talk to your child. And look up also on Rockland World Radio. We have archived all of our shows for your listening and educational pleasure. I want to thank our engineer this morning, Richard Quinn, and remind folks we are going to be on hiatus for the winter, and we will be back this spring. So thank you very much, and keep talking.
It's not just radio, it's Rockland World Radio. RocklandWorldRadio.com.